This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. We are back on the People Speak Radio, and it is Tuesday, May 26th. Tonight, we are on live for 1 hour. Join us every week on Tuesday for live radio. On the People Speak, we do encourage your audience participation. Call us at 1-888-429-5471. Again, 429-5471 for questions and comments. It's appreciated. You can also find us at bbsradio.com for more information. We do have tonight with us one of the most requested guest on talk radio. I have invited him here to discuss his book, A Cosmic War, Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics, and Ancient Texts. Joseph Farrell is an inspirational, iconic figure amongst radio media. I am delighted and excited to introduce him. Welcome to the People Speak, Joseph. Thank you for coming and sharing this hour with me. How are you doing this evening?
I'm fine, Sophia. Thank you for having me on.
You are very welcome. You know, I just want to jump right into this because when I was reading your book, in the very first part, you went into depth detail on scalar physics and this technology. And during the experience of me reading, through the entire first part, I was experiencing energetic attacks and what was like anxiety. And I thought it was just from reading while I was traveling on the train. But when I noticed when I wasn't on the train and I was finishing up the last part of the first part, that I was still experiencing this energetic attack. And it wasn't through any other part of the book but that part. Have you heard of this? Has anybody shared this experience with you before, prior to me?
Well, no one has shared an experience like that, but I certainly had similar emotions writing it.
Oh, I bet, because, you know, whatever this is, it's strong, it's powerful, and wow, it is destructive. What is this technology?
Well, it's, you know, I approach it kind of from the standpoint of trying to read some of these ancient texts and kind of read behind them to see what they might be trying to say. And in that book, I'm talking about the destruction of a planet that used to exist in our asteroid belt. And I started out, if I recall correctly, in that book, it's been so long since I've written it, I don't remember the details. But I started out in that book, in that first part, with kind of a review of the astronomical work of the former astronomer of the U.S. Naval Laboratory, Dr. Tom Van Flandern, wrote a wonderful book, Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets, in which he revives this 19th century idea of astronomers that the asteroid belt represented an exploded planet. And in the book, he goes through various models, and you have to kind of sit down and read the book. I try and quote some of these passages in my book, where he's trying to come up with an explanation. Well, how do we have a planet that just exploded? And he proposes various models, the first being that there may have been some sort of natural atomic reactor in the core of the planet that went supercritical and exploded. And, you know, natural reactors do exist. We found evidence of these things in Africa, for example. But you can tell he's not terribly satisfied with that explanation. Then he proposes the idea that, well, you know, to get that kind of energy, the energy that would be required to blow up a planet, perhaps it was in the core of the planet, there may have been an accumulation of antimatter, and it came into contact with matter. You had the total annihilation reaction, and the planet exploded. And again, you can tell he's not too happy with that, because he knew, you know, just as anyone would know in physics, that antimatter, while it certainly exists, we've been able to create it in our accelerators and so on. It just does not exist in a very large scale.
Can I stop you right there? Because when
Sure.
you say that it's created, it's almost seeming like that this is what creates the cosmos and the stars. Because reading your book, it feels like it's like I'm almost like imagining like the war of when they were creating the cosmos and like placing these stars amongst us, and for this power and this technology to radiate this energy, which you also define as an aspect that may involve a conscious mind manipulation to impress electrodynamics on targeted biological system and intelligent life. And,
right.
and that has to do with paleophysics, but this antimatter seems to be very destructive but creative.
Well, yes, it is. You know, antimatter, when it comes into contact with matter, it's as I said, it's a total annihilation reaction. So everything gets converted back to pure energy. So it's at the same time tremendously destructive, but the result of the process is this huge release of energy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's possible, but the problem here is that, and this is a problem that Van Flandern would have known very well, is that there's what physicists would call the antimatter-matter asymmetry in the universe. It's a problem that's really kind of dogged theoretical physics in a certain sense, because, you know, there's so much matter in the universe and so little antimatter, and the question is why. So you can tell he's not terribly satisfied with even that model for why this planet blew up. Mm-hmm. So finally, he comes, you read him carefully, and then he comes at one point in his book where he proposes, well, you know, you can tell he's struggling against this hypothesis, but you can also tell that he is kind of coming to it reluctantly, but by a kind of a process of ineluctable logic. And that is, he says, well, perhaps this was some accident of technology. Or, and then he goes on to say, perhaps it was the result of deliberate action. And those are his words, deliberate action. And of course, what he's really saying there, if you stop and think about it, it was blown up in a war. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what I think you see in some of those ancient texts and other things that I examine in that book. So once we've come to the idea, number one, of a technology, and then number two, its destructive application in a war, mm-hmm. then you're dealing with, first of all, a physics sufficient to do that. And then secondly, you're dealing with the ability to engineer that physics to do that. And so what would be sufficient to blow up a planet? Well, the bottom line here is that you would have to have a physics that would be capable, so to speak, of engineering the fabric of space-time or zero-point energy or quantum vacuum flux or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. You'd have to have a technology that would allow you to do that and manipulate that, so to speak, on the laboratory bench. And once you admit the possibility that that technology might exist, then if you scale it up, so to speak, you'd have a weaponization potential that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match. So you look at some of these ancient texts, and in particular the one that I talked about in that book, among many others, is the old Babylonian epic, the Enuma Elish, which many academics think is a creation account. But, you know, I defy anybody to sit down and read that and come up with any other conclusion that it's not a creation epic. It's a war epic, because particularly in the fourth tablet of that particular epic, you have a very detailed description of this war, and you have a very detailed description of the process of Marduk destroying Tiamat. And we have to remember that many times these names of gods and goddesses in ancient lore are also planetary names. And so the destruction of Tiamat, what's very interesting when you read it is you read about Marduk driving winds into the body of Tiamat, and then she begins to groan and weep and so on and so forth, and convulses essentially. And then he, so to speak, drives in the final wind, all right? And the way it looked to me, or the way I interpreted the text, is what you have there is a description of the ability to introduce standing waves, vibrations, within an entire planet. And it would be kind of analogous to the old idea that soldiers have to break step when they're marching across a long bridge. You know, if you're marching in step, you keep pulsing energy into the bridge, which ultimately it won't be able to damp, and then it'll finally collapse. Well, the same idea, if you read that text carefully, is what's going on here. Energy keeps being pulsed into Tiamat. She's unable to damp that energy and just finally blows up. All right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're dealing with a very destructive type of science.
Is this what we see that happened during 9/11? Now, prior to 9/11,
that's a great question.
Prior to 9/11, Dr. Stephen Greer, who happened to be a formal guest of mine, he was gaining mass media attention, and he was going to disclose so much information. And one of the information I believe was that it was planned for 30 years. Approximately, that they were going to invade Iraq. And before he could disclose this information, bam, here comes 9/11.
Right.
Now, it was 2003 when we went and invaded into Iraq. Now, did we invade Iraq for this ancient weaponry that we are speaking of now?
Oh boy, you've opened up two Pandora's boxes there in one question. So, you know, as far as 9/11 is concerned, I have thought consistently since the Twin Towers came down that no method or hypothesis of their destruction by means of any form of controlled demolition, be it nanothermite, controlled demolition planting inside the building, can explain adequately all of the data that is available and explain them adequately in the sense that it accounts for the weirdness of it. I've always thought that their destruction was the result of some sort of exotic physics and technology. Now, the biggest problem with that view, and Dr. Greer would be the first to point it out, is that on any conventional physics analysis, the amount of energy required to do that would be just astronomical. And on any conventional physics analysis, analysis of the publicly known technology, it's simply beyond us. But again, you know, I'm kind of like in the Sherlock Holmes school here. You have to go where the data leads you. And I just don't think the data leads to any sort of controlled demolition. Now, that said, you asked about going into Iraq. I also have consistently thought that there were other reasons other than simply going in to get rid of the Ba'athist regime in Iraq, that there were other reasons to go in other than simply projecting American power and acquiring bases in the Middle East and protecting oil and all of that. And one of the reasons I've always entertained is that some of this may have been also to search for or prevent others from searching for, and that's a key thing here, some of this ancient technology. And I, you know, I've pointed in various books of mine to the looting of the Baghdad Museum, which to my mind is still an extremely fishy incident, because ostensibly the story is that American soldiers were seen going into the museum and removing stuff. So, you know, everybody thinks we did it. Well, it's very easy for people to put on American uniforms and go in and loot the Baghdad Museum. The second problem with this is that if you look at the story, the, so to speak, the official narrative of the incident, a Marine colonel was appointed to recover the looted items. And he did, in fact, do so. He recovered a great deal of the looted art treasures from the museum. The problem is that there was also the theft of a lot of cuneiform tablets. And we have yet to see any story about what happened to them. Where do the people think or suspect that they went? And what was on them? This is the part of the story that's dropped right off the radar. Now, I find that very suspicious, because we were also told when the Baghdad Museum was looted that it had all of the appearance of being an inside job, that the people knew exactly where to go and knew exactly what they were looking for and so on and so forth, which, again, you know, I don't disagree with, and I don't suspect that there's anything untrue about that. What we have to remember, however, is that when we invaded Iraq, the Allied forces gave a notice to the French and the Germans to pull out their archaeological teams that had been working and digging around Iraq for Saddam Hussein and get them out of the country because we were coming in. And this, to my mind, is a third part of the mystery here, because we have never been told, in my opinion, the full truth about what items were missing from the Baghdad Museum, and we have never been told why whoever it was that did loot it knew exactly where to look and what to go for. Now, we have to remember that the French and the Germans, having their archaeological teams in Iraq, would have been keeping field catalogs of what it was they were digging up. And to my mind, again, you look at Colonel Bogdanovich's book about the Baghdad Museum looting. He never once refers to these field catalogs. So in other words, there's a big mystery here. I do think that there is an aspect of this that they were looking for something. They may have either found it and were attempting to keep the French and Germans away from it, or vice versa. It may be that the French and Germans found it and are not telling us, you know.
Well, speaking so, about the Germans now, you see, Germans were in Iraq in the 40s, were they not?
Oh, yes,
there was
yes,
a network,
absolutely.
There was a society network of Nazi Germans there. Now, but
sure.
What you mentioned in your book is that after World War II, that network completely just vanished. Now, then after World War II, if we notice that the UN came into establishment October 24th, 1945, and ever since the UN has been in power, we see a whole different war. And that war is taking place between Israel and Palestine, which has never stopped and is a much more silent war. What is your take on this? That might, you know, do you see any relation here?
Yes, I do. And it's very complicated. I don't get into that issue in the Cosmic War, but I do get into the background of that issue in another one of my books called The Nazi International. Because what people must understand is that prior to and during World War II, in fact, it goes all the way back to World War I, to be quite honest with you, Germany deliberately pursued a course of, if you want to use Peter Levenda's term, of weaponizing religion. And in this case, the religion they chose to weaponize was Islam. And this they did. The Kaiser persuaded Sultan Mehmet II of Turkey. I think it was Mehmet II of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, to issue a fatwa declaring jihad against the Allies. This is the first modern use of jihad. So in other words, it was always a part of German policy. The Nazis continued this policy of making contact with these radical Muslim groups. And they did so particularly during World War II in Iran. And in fact, the name Iran itself was something the Nazis persuaded the Shah to change the name from Persia to Iran, because Iran in Farsi means Aryan.
Okay. And that's interesting, because the UN is the backbone of the UN is the Baha'i faith, and the founder of the Baha'i faith comes from Persia.
Yeah, yeah. So you had these Nazi networks inside of Iran. They functioned in Iran throughout the war, partisan activities against the Allied Lend-Lease supply route that went through Iran up into the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. They had, as you mentioned, they had networks in Iraq. The British, they actually staged a coup in Iraq in 1941. The British had to invade to depose the puppet government that the Nazis had installed. You had other Nazi contact with radical Islamic groups. You had Nazi contact with the Muslim Brotherhood, both during and after, this is a key point, after World War II, you had the visit of al-Husseini to visit Nazi Germany during the war. You can go online and find pictures of him sitting there having a chat with Hitler. Al-Husseini raised Muslim troops for the Waffen-SS. So you have this pervasive Nazi connection to some of these very radical Islamic groups. And I'll cut to the chase here without going into any further details. You can read about them in my books. You can read about them in other researchers. But to cut to the chase, there are aspects of this so-called war on terror that persuade me that maybe that's just the cover story, that maybe what we are really battling is what I've been calling the Nazi International. And let me explain briefly what I mean by that term. In my research, I've been very careful to point out to people that the Nazis didn't just roll over and go quietly into the night, hiding in jungle huts in the Amazon basin. You know, this is the typical story. This is the way it's presented. What I mean by Nazi International is, on the contrary, you had the establishment prior to the end of the war, an international network that was well-financed, quite literally rolling in money, that had its own kind of extraterritorial state, if you want to look at it that way, and had tremendous networks of intelligence, connections to major corporations, and so on and so forth. And part of this post-war story is that these connections with radical Islamic groups were certainly continued and even to a certain extent fostered. So it's another huge story, but I genuinely think my gut tells me that there's something fishy about this war on terror. There's something else going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely, because what I have noticed is that what's going on in the war of terror is that it's a holy war, and
yes,
that it's to unite world religions into this Baha'i faith that is backed by the UN. And the UN has said that they don't favor any religion, but it seems like they favor them all and want them all united into the Baha'i faith. I don't know if you know anything about this, if this is something new, but this is something that I have been thinking about for quite some time. And it was through, actually, Blavatsky's work when I had discovered this. And just to retreat back here just for a moment, and I don't mean to jump around here, but I have so much I want to just discuss with you. I don't believe I have enough time. You talk about the Tablets of Destinies. The Tablets of Destinies. Now, Blavatsky calls them the indestructible tablets of the astrolite, and I believe this is in connection to the Akashic records. Are you familiar with this?
Well, yes, I talk a great deal in the Cosmic War about the Tablets of Destinies, and it is interesting to note that in the Epic of Ninurta, which is one of the texts that I not only cite in the Cosmic War, I actually reproduce the whole thing and make people read it. And the reason why I make them read it is you sit down, you read this thing. It's called an epic, but for the life of me, I can't figure out why anyone would call it an epic, because it's like sitting down and reading the index to an old Sears catalog.
Let me explain for a moment here what the Akashic Records is.
I know what they are. I know what they
can
are.
Because from what I know the Akashic Records is, it records human thoughts, human behavior from the past and the future into now.
Right.
Is that what you believe it to be as well?
Yes and no. What I think the Akashic Records are, again, is what some physicists would call the information content of the field. In other words, they would be the sum total of all the information sort of etched into the materia prima, as it were. And thus, when you get into the Epic of Ninurta, what you discover is at the end of the Cosmic War, they take some of these tablets, these stones, and some of them are carted off for use in other purposes. Some of them are destroyed because they're very destructive and they don't want anybody to use these, whatever these technologies were. And then there's a very, very few, like three or four of these things that cannot be destroyed. And so they hide them. And again, going back to your earlier question, do I think that maybe they went into Iraq also with the purpose of looking for some of these things? And the short answer, in my opinion, would be yes. If they didn't, if they didn't find them, they were at least looking for information on where they might be. So again, this raises the question of why have we not heard anything about all the stolen cuneiform tablets? You know, what was on those tablets? Who has them now? And so on. So yes, I do think there's a connection between the Tablets of Destinies in these ancient texts and what Blavatsky and others are referring to as the Akashic Records. But again, I tend to view references like that in texts and try to interpret them from some standpoint grounded in modern scientific theory or hypothesis. And in this case, I tend to view Akashic Records as being this information content of the field that physicists talk about.
Right, which is a non-physical field that's coming from an astral plane.
Yeah, and when I think astral,
I'm thinking starry, cosmo, illumin, aether, ether.
Right, right.
Now, there's something that's been on my mind for quite some time, and this might just seem kind of left field for you here, but scientists are desperately seeking for planets that can sustain life. Now, is it because perhaps that Earth might be the only living planet left in our solar system?
To be honest with you, Sophia, I don't know. I've noticed the same thing that you've noticed, and it raises all sorts of suspicions and implications. I honestly don't know. You have all of these studies being produced now about mining asteroids, mining the moon, terraforming Mars, and so on and so forth. And clearly there is some sort of big push that they're trying to get into people's minds about space. And one of the things, as you mentioned, is they're looking for Earth-like planets elsewhere. And then the question arises, well, why are they looking for it? And you hear all sorts of theories, including, you know, imminent planetary catastrophe or what have you. I'm not a subscriber to any of those theories. I think there are perhaps other reasons they might be doing this. And one of them might be they're trying to figure out, you know, where all these UFOs are coming from. Another might be they've already been in some sort of contact and are sort of preparing us for it. You know, all these theories are out there. I certainly have no unique insight or sources or anything like that that give me a definite line on what's going on. I just notice the same thing that you notice and question why all of this space news is being pushed so dramatically, it seems, in the last couple of years.
Well, Earth seems to be, you know, this planetary, like, star because, you know, we have this pole that runs through Earth, obviously, and I believe this pole is a purpose for the Earth's travel, okay? And but the thing is that I've seen somewhere that the sun has these similar poles, but many poles that come from the sun. Now, if each planet has a pole, a Polaris star to associate it into each planet, and therefore the sun also has these poles, it seems like that these planets may connect back into the sun. And now, with that being said, if the sun has multiple poles that have more planets in the system, do you think that though that could be because of planets that may have existed that are no longer here that we discussed earlier on?
Well, I'm not sure I'm understanding what you mean by pole. If you mean an axis of rotation, if you mean magnetic poles,
like, for instance, the North Pole, the South Pole is one pole. It is the soul of the planet. It's the pole of the planet. And
okay, I got you. Mm-hmm. I got you. Do I think there might be other planets within the solar system?
Sun does have many poles such as that are similar to the poles that run through the planets, and this seems to be like star-like because it's called the Polaris star. I don't know if you ever looked at a map of the universe, and inside the center is the Polaris star, which is the pole that runs through Earth.
So, in other words, does the sun have a pole star?
Joseph, let's go into a break here, and then when we come back, we'll discuss this more. Take it away, Don. Thank you.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
And we are back with our guest, Joseph Farrell. I am your host, Sophia Ray. And when we went off into break, we were talking about, Polaris stars and connecting back into the sun. You know what? I think it's very complicated. And, you know, there's so much more that we have to discuss, and there's not enough time. I'm not quite sure if you're really understanding. I know it's very complicated, something very hard to wrap our heads around here. If you can just quickly, and as much as possible, do you believe that this pole is part of a creation that was created from our ancient ancestors or these ancient gods, and did they dig out the Middle Earth to create this? And is this part of this technology that we are discussing tonight?
Well, let me put it this way.
Your opinion, that is.
Well, let me put it this way. There is within physics the idea of what's called quantum entanglement. There is the idea of non-locality. And what this means is if you entrain two photons with the same information and then send them racing across the universe, so to speak, in opposite directions, if you make an observation of one photon, that information is immediately, instantly transferred to the other, no matter how far away it is. Now, it's interesting to ponder if that principle could be extended from the quantum scale to much larger physical scales on the order of a solar system or a galaxy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a bit of thinking now going on within physics that suggests there is some sort of analog or equivalent of that principle on the macro scale. So, yeah, if you look at it from a physics point of view, I think you'd have to say, yes, there's some sort of connectivity taking place between planets and their local star that goes beyond mere gravitational or electromagnetic interactions. There's something else going on, but we don't really understand as yet what it is. So
I totally agree.
Yeah, I'm open to the idea. Let's put it that way.
Absolutely. You know, we do have a caller with us on the line.
Sure.
Caller, Mike, go ahead. Come on in.
Hi, this is Mike from California. Joseph, you earlier someone asked a question about 9/11. I was wondering if you're aware of Dr. Judy Wood, who believes that
very
Trump
aware.
Kind of knew. Yes, you know, people think she's crazy, and they misquote her and take her out of context that she thinks it's a laser beam from the space. But I've been studying her website, and she has a book out about it, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, she talks about the towers literally pulverizing and turning to dust.
Right.
You know,
well,
I mean, something odd went on there.
That's one of the data sets that I was thinking about very specifically when I said what I said. I know Dr. Wood's work. I have a copy of her book. There's many other things that she points out that are anomalous to any idea of controlled demolition, mini nukes, nanothermite, you know, all the favored models of the 9/11 truth community. You know, and I agree with her because, you know, the process of reasoning that she uses in her book was more or less the same process of reasoning that I had when I saw the towers come down and was started looking at some of the evidences that were gathered afterwards. So, you know, I'm not agreed in all details with her, certainly, and she wouldn't be agreed with all details with me. But I think in the main that she's made an evidentiary case that has to be considered and looked at. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mike. There's so much more that we need to discuss, but I do have some questions that's coming into some of our guests, and I want to get to some of those. So I'm going to go to a question from Frank in Missouri. Frank is asking you, Mr. Farrell, have you considered the claim made by those that believe in the flat Earth theory, and what do you think of them?
I've heard these things. I, quite frankly and honestly, don't spend much time with them. I'm pretty much in line with the standard Galilean, Keplerian, Newtonian, Einsteinian view of things.
Okay. And we'll go to the next question. And the next question is coming in from John in Cincinnati. Do we actually live in a self-created dream world? If so, are we individually responsible for all this madness and craziness?
That's a really interesting question to ponder. It's a very interesting question to ponder because, again, if you go back to quantum mechanics, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tells you that you cannot measure the position of an electron at the same time as you measure its momentum. So in other words, what this did, and physics has been wrestling with this philosophical conundrum ever since, because what this meant was that the observer, to a certain extent, predetermines the outcome of an experiment before they even start, and therefore that there is an observer-dependent sort of reality. So then you magnify this to many, many individual observers, and what you discover is that quantum physics, when it's talking about its particles and so on and so forth, what it's talking about is a set of statistical probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And then that raises the question, well, all right, what happens if, say, we wanted to test the scientific laws, so to speak, of what would be the effect of mass group consciousness on the macrocosmic world that we live in? What would you do? Well, one of the things, and we talk about this on my website, this sort of thing a lot, what would you do? Well, you'd start playing around with memory, for one thing, of large groups of people to see if by implanting false memories or false stories, there was an actual physical response in in the medium. So, you know, there are books out there by physicists that are talking about the way that the universe is constructed appears to be somehow holographic in nature.
Absolutely.
So yeah, there, you know, you have all of these ideas going on in contemporary physics. I do think, let me put it this way. I do think that there is such a relationship. However, in saying that, I don't think that we can just say that if we think about something, it's going to happen. Reality doesn't work like that. We can't take a walk off of a skyscraper and expect the law of gravity not to occur. I think the reality is probably going to be much more complex, that there's a set of feedback loops from the observer to what we call external reality, and then vice versa, that we don't quite understand yet. And this, again, brings me back to my social engineering experiment idea. How would you test that? Well, you'd have to set up some sort of experiment where you're trying to discover how those laws operate. And I think there's a bit of evidence, some of it kind of wild, but I think there's a bit of evidence that they might be trying some of these things.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think that there's just so much going on. And like you said before, it's complex. It's just too much to take on. Not enough people have the energy to think for themselves. I mean, if everybody's thinking the same thing, then nobody is thinking. But
right.
We're going to go from here. Let's go to another question. Mike in California. Is there any relation of this new weapon technology in the Edward Snowden leaks or any other whistleblowers who back you up?
Well, I don't know of any. I haven't really followed the individual leaks in the Snowden case, so I don't know if there's anything that he's been talking about in terms of weapons technology or anything like that. As to the question, is there anything to back me up? I think there is. You have to look at certain ideas in physics. You have to look at some of the patents that have been taken out since the end of World War II. But that's a very difficult case. And then even with those things, you still have to make an argument. In other words, you have to interpret what you're seeing. So I leave it up to my readers to decide, you know, is this possible, or maybe there's a different interpretation we can put on all of this. I think you can make this case. I attempt to make it in my books, but not everybody's agreed with them, you know, that, and that's fine. Because if everybody was agreed, it'd be like you say, no one is thinking. So.
Is it because that, you know, we get energy from dead things, that is why perhaps that we have a dead planet that might be, well, it's the moon, it's a satellite, and we have, you know, the sun and the moon. The sun seems to be the transmitter, the moon seems to be a satellite, but there's a theory going on that I've heard that the moon is, one source says that the moon is a dead planet, but it is a satellite at the same time, but it's created from the material of Earth. Have you heard anything about this?
Oh, yeah. That's an old theory that's been around in astrophysics for a long time, the so-called fission theory. One version of it is that the moon fissioned very early on in the history of the solar system, roughly from the region that would now be the Pacific Ocean on the Earth, and then ended up where it is. The problem with that theory was actually caused by some of the Apollo missions that brought back moon rocks from, you know, that they dug up from the surface of the moon, brought back moon rocks that were older than the Earth. So the scientists began to change their model of, you know, how did the moon get there? And the current favored model is that the moon was a celestial body that got captured by the Earth's gravitational field. Now, the problem here is, if you stop and think about it, like a physicist for a moment, the moon is in a very nearly circular orbit. So if we have the capture model being true, as the moon gets captured in the Earth's gravitational field, it's going to begin to accelerate. And if it comes into planetary orbit with the Earth, in other words, if it's truly and genuinely captured, then that orbit, by the nature of the case, is going to be much more of an ellipse than it is the nearly perfectly circular orbit that we see. So in other words, this means, in its turn, that the moon, as it entered the Earth's gravitational field, had to be slowed down. Okay. In other words, yeah, in other words, somebody parked it there. You know?
So, is this why the moon doesn't spin around and we don't see the other side ever?
Well, actually, the moon does spin. You see, you've just raised another problem for the capture theory. The moon does rotate on its axis just like the Earth does, but it rotates at exactly the right periodicity so that you only see 60% of the surface of the moon at any one time, and it's always the same surface, okay?
Well, the planets are spinning, but are we actually revolving around the sun? Are we spinning around the sun at all?
Oh, yeah, I think so, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is where I depart from the flat Earth theory that's been going around on the Internet out there lately. You know, the celestial mechanics of the moon, if you stop and think about all the weird things that it's doing, add up to such massive statistical problems, you know, that it just wandered here aimlessly and then got parked in this nice, neat, tidy circular orbit and has its own rotation that keeps its surface permanently pointed to the Earth when we see it. And on top of all of this, it's at exactly the right distance from the Earth to blot out the corona of the sun during lunar eclipses and so on ad infinitum. So we end up with a massive problem. You know, I like to quote Isaac Newton here, the moon is the only thing that gives me a headache, because, you know, all of these improbabilities add up to the possibility that someone just parked it there. And in fact, it's very interesting to note that some of the first people that proposed that idea were Soviet scientists back in the 1960s, when they started looking at all of this, and some of their lunar probes had begun to send back information. There were scientists in the Soviet Union that came right out and said, well, you know, maybe this thing is nothing but a big, huge spaceship that somebody parked there. So, you know,
sure.
And nobody took them seriously at the time. But, you know, you look at the physics and you have to wonder.
We are coming to the very end of the show here. And there's one more thing I wanted to talk about before we can go here. And then here I go, jumping around again. But in your book, you talk about Sphinx and Egypt, okay? And you associate it with Sekhmet. And I was wondering why Sekhmet and not with Anubis? Because it seems that it's not, for me, in my opinion, I don't see the Sphinx as half human and half feline. I see it as half human and half canine.
Well, I do too, actually. I don't know, I don't recall that part of my book, to be quite honest with you. It's been so long since I've sat down to look at it. But I look at it this way. There's clearly evidence that the head on the Sphinx is not of the same scale that it should be when you compare it to the body. In other words, it looks like the head has been recarved at some later point in its history. This has been pointed out by various people. And I do think that it's not only possible, but likely that there was a very, very different head, and it may have been a canine head on the Sphinx at one point. clearly the head that's on there now is not original to the structure. It's just too small.
Mm-hmm. We do have some more questions, and since we are still here, Angelica in New York, what about the interplanet war and extraterrestrials?
Ah, good question. In my thinking, and for a variety of reasons that we can perhaps do another show on someday, but in my thinking, I think if you're going to go to the extraterrestrial route in this ancient cosmic war, you have to look at whoever else may be out there as, so to speak, our genetic cousins. In other words, they're not going to look all that different from us. They may be larger or smaller in stature and so on and so forth. But my thinking is that they're going to look more or less humanoid in appearance. And the reason I say that is, again, you go back to some of these ancient texts, particularly the Mesopotamian texts.
This is the part I hate of the show most, where I have to cut you up because this is the end. And I'm sorry. I hope to have you back on the show. I had a great time with you. I want to thank you so much for being here with me. I want to thank our engineer, Don Newsome. I want to thank our guests for listening. Please join us next week with Rick Chicago. Let's unite through love and light. Take care and be good. Good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.